Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Matt Robson, Executive Director at TSG Consulting.
Cool. I think that the obvious place to start with you is clearly the experience in the British Army. And actually, I did a podcast a few days ago with a guy called Tim Carmichael, and he is the CDO of the British Army currently, actually. It's interesting that I've not really ever spoke with anyone or people who've had background in the British Army, and then all of a sudden in the space of 10 days I've spoke with two. But I can only imagine spending, I think it was 20 plus years in the British Army is I suppose probably a great habit forming place, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, when I joined, I was a university student. I was 19, and I guess I was kind of not yet the finished article. And what that kind of officer training does to you is it in a sense is a bit of a sausage machine. So there's certain behaviours, there's certain responses and drills it teaches you, but it gives you a wider and different outlook on life. So for example, how you approach problem solving, it gives you a structure and a generic method to look at a situation in order to understand what's going on, understand what you need to do, and how you're going to deal with it. And that's not so dissimilar to what you do in consultancy when you look at a as-is, to-be, and roadmap type situation. And it works in the small, but it also works in quite large and complex situations. But I think for me personally, it just gave me an incredible amount of confidence in myself. It allowed me to tap into potential that I didn't even realize I had. But definitely gave me a set of skills and an outlook that enabled me to be successful. And, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's probably the one thing that for me personally really made me in life and kind of got me to today. You know, I went to university, I did a master's degree, I got as far as studying for a PhD from a sort of academic perspective, and that was all great, but that wasn't really what gave me the set of life skills, the outlook, and I guess the confidence to push myself forward and get where I am.
Yeah, I think it's rare that you do hear people say that kind of those, I just call them kind of box checking things, right? You know, university check, like whatever check, you know, all these kind of things. You don't kind of get that until you are kind of thrown out into a level of discomfort, and you're forced to actually kind of achieve something.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, if you think about, forget operations, even just like normal military training, the only people that get anywhere near the kind of level of stress, whether that be sort of physical, emotional, or even mental stress, are people who work in the emergency services. And even then, it's kind of, there's a difference in what those guys deal with. But it does really help you understand what your limits are. It also allows you in a controlled environment to understand what your pressure responses are. So if you look at situations like, I know it sounds a bit lame in comparison, but like in IT, when major systems go down, so like working with people like banks where payment systems go down, the ATM network goes down, people who can keep their head straight when they're really under pressure, time pressure, when they've got people shouting at them, there's money building up in a queue, or people can't get the money out of the bank, whatever. You know, it's people that can keep a clear head, keep a focus, and resolve what's going on that will be successful. You know, I've seen people absolutely fall apart under relatively mild pressure, you know, either throw a wobbler or just lose the power of coherent thought. And because they've never had to explore their limits before. And if the first time you do that is when you're actually already dealing with a really serious situation, then, you know, some people can succeed in that situation. Other people do fall apart. Whereas the military training kind of, you know, you've been there, done it, got the T-shirt and a few scars to go with it.
Right. Yeah. Again, I think that, you know, the military is a great example, but I think just in a practical sense as well, for a lot of other people who, you know, won't have been in the military or people who are listening to this show, I think just in general, the principle that, you know, you are kind of being put outside your comfort zone and actually, you know, doing things, that's necessary. I think that we call it innovation now, and it seems that technology and innovation are seemingly synonymous, right? But I do think that in order to keep pushing and so on and so forth, if you're not making yourself uncomfortable in, you know, a new test or whatever the technical thing might be to overcome, or the management scenario that you have to overcome, you really aren't necessarily growing. And I think it's quite a cliched thing in a lot of senses, but there's a lot of truth behind that as well.
Yeah, it's funny that there's a book by a very, very old Chinese general called Sun Tzu, called The Art of War, and it talks about the maneuverist approach to warfare, and it's something that the British Army adopted, which is you can win a battle without actually, you know, firing a gun or harming anyone by getting inside the enemy's decision cycle. So in other words, if you can think past them and outmaneuver them, you can position yourself and posture to beat them. And technology change is kind of doing that to the human race, that the pace of change is such that the kind of, you know, technology's got inside our decision cycle and we can't keep up. And, you know, Elon Musk saying the other day that the greatest threat to stability and peace is actually artificial intelligence, because it will make decisions at a rate and in a manner that is out of keeping with how humans make decisions, and faster than we can keep up and respond. In terms of people in their daily lives and in their careers, you know, you see an awful lot of people that stay in the same rut for many, many years, and they might be perfectly comfortable and happy doing that, but it doesn't allow you to develop as a human being. You know, I've been lucky that I've been able to travel quite a lot, meet lots of different people through aspects of my life, and I think it genuinely does develop you as a human being. It develops your understanding of what's possible, what's out there, but it also broadens the mind. So I think the idea of challenging yourself physically, mentally, emotionally is a really important thing. You know, some people choose to do charity work, which challenges them to deal with difficult situations. Some people work, you know, through sort of like fitness regimes, push their bodies because it's good for their mental development. You know, other people just lead challenging lives or are in difficult places in their life that forces them to adapt, improvise and overcome.
Yeah, it's an interesting time we're in at the moment, and I want to talk about obviously kind of some of the things that you're involved with now on the technical side as much as anything. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've been involved in technology for a while now, and, you know, just seeing the rate of change that things are happening, you know, what are some of the biggest, I suppose, challenges that you're kind of seeing and facing in order to kind of, you know, keep up and ensure, you know, efficiencies and meeting, you know, business outcomes and goals now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's this idea of quality, and there's a great friend of mine who we worked together for a number of years called Rich Rogers, who's a Yorkshire man now residing out in Australia. And he's done a lot of thinking and writing about what quality means in the digital age. And I think one of the observations that I'd make is, you know, the world of apps and agile, and that's agile in the sort of definitive sense, and agile is in fleet of foot technology, is that in some ways we're more accepting of failure. If you get a free app or buy an app, you know, for your iPhone or whatever for 59p or wherever much it is these days, and it fails, often you don't care because that's kind of like your level of quality expectation. Whereas I get unusually irate when the iPlayer or Facebook doesn't work, and I'm getting those, well, I'm not paying for them, I'm not getting them for free either, but you know, our expectations of quality have really, really changed. And I think also our expectations of the pace of change have really changed. And if you look at how sort of big, previously quite monolithic institutions like banks and insurers are investing heavily in technology, some of that's about artificial intelligence, straight through processing, so taking cost out of doing the same thing by allowing machines to make decisions and do the processing rather than people. Some of it's because as human beings, we're becoming more demanding in terms of the pace of change. So if you look at the aggregators, people like Money Supermarket, you know, their ability to reprice, change their products, change their go-to-market very, very quickly is something that keeps them in the game. So it's the speed of responsiveness, but also a changing expectation of quality in terms of the service that we receive, whether it's for apps, free services, websites, or stuff that we're paying for.
Yeah, and how do you, you know, I suppose, manage to stay on top of that as far as what's the next, the latest and greatest? Because it's not always necessarily the latest technology that might be the correct move to, or the on for as far as investing in that technology. So is that kind of a balancing act as well? You know, you have to keep one eye on what's happening tomorrow as much as actually taking care of the activities today. And you know, is that seemingly quite challenging now?
No, and I think the irony is the more things change, the more they stay the same. So, you know, often when people ask us for help, they've either got a problem they can't solve or they've got a problem that's crystallized and they need help to resolve. And the reasons why they are where they are the same. They've been all the way through my career. It's often poor decision making, doing the wrong things in the wrong way at the wrong time. You know, not measuring quality, poor planning, poor leadership. So a lot of the factors that cause failure or problems are actually the same as they've ever been. And while we have, you know, emerging technologies, developing methods, so the maturity of Agile, DevOps coming to the fore, the things that cock them up or get in the way, it's not necessarily say it's all about the human beings and the people. It's not actually, but, you know, the factors that drive failure or underperformance are actually to a point the same. I think the change in technology and technology delivery might accelerate or exacerbate the scale of problems and challenges, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're new. I think the other thing that's a positive development, certainly when you look at things like quality and testing, is that testing is, as a discipline, having to reinvent itself. You know, the same debates come around about, you know, is automation going to kill testing? Short answer, no, don't be silly. But by the same point, testers are a very different breed now than they were 15, 20 years ago. You know, they've become far more tools literate. They've become far more methodology literate. They've also had to learn to communicate in a far more effective manner with a far wider audience because, you know, methods like Agile expose them to a wider range of roles more often than they previously would. But also in the digital age, your people working in quality and testing are far more product and customer advocates. So they are acting as the voice of the customer, the quality gateway. And that is a different gig to just sitting in a darkened room, punching buttons, checking numbers.
It's almost like we talked about this a bit actually quite recently, but it's almost like a hybrid now is expected of technical people, isn't it?
Yeah, I think roles are less clearly defined, or rather they're broader than they were. There's a greater role fluidity. So when does someone stop being an automated tester and become a developer of test scripts? You know, the overlap between business analysis and the acceptance process, you know, where you have test-driven development, where in effect developers can undertake your acceptance tests, and then testing itself becomes more of an emotional confidence-building exercise than necessarily a box-ticking exercise. You know, the schools of thought, like the context-driven school, which has a very strong following and is an emerging movement within testing, but that isn't necessarily conformed to by all, but that has a very strong sort of philosophical angle to it. So yeah, there's definitely a blurring of lines. People definitely need a wider set of skills. I think the key change for all roles is the ability to communicate effectively and work with others, whether it's other people within your own discipline or cross-discipline teams. And that, for me, is the real change.
Is it, you know, as far as the line of work you're in now, you know, is it particularly compelling for you? I'm sure that, you know, a lot of the considerations about, you know, what motivates and compels you is the outcomes and the projects that you work on. But, you know, I can imagine now being in technology, it must be a great thrill to kind of work with a lot of different customers, a lot of different clients and see, you know, a lot of the scope of what's happening out there. Is that something that I suppose is particularly enjoyable for you at the moment?
We're really lucky that we work with some very interesting clients, and some of whom I wish I could name, but they have like national and in a few cases international significance. So some of the systems that we've worked on underpin the UK economy and the wider economy, and that stuff's really cool. I mean, one of our clients, I think it was their 2015 or 2016 turnover was 633 trillion euro. So you're into sort of monopoly money figures. But it's the idea that we're helping them innovate, get stuff live safely, and that there is a wider impact of the work we do positively. You know, where you're working on transformation of government bodies or whether you're delivering first-to-market technologies, you know, we've been very lucky that we've been involved with that. And I tell you what, it's really engaging. But again, the projects and programs that deliver them do have the sort of the same challenges. But it's the idea that you make it happen. And I think the focus on the outcome is one, about the cool stuff we're doing. But two, you know, we tend to embed with the clients we work with. So we work hand in hand with them rather than having sort of some sort of firm gateway or demarcation. And it's a credit to the teams that I work with here at TSG that they're great at blending in. They keep their identity, but that idea of the collective to deliver the outcome, it is one of the things that I think defines our guys, but it also makes the work really engaging because you really do share in the success as well as the pain of delivering for the end client. And actually simple things like going to an ATM, taking money out and then realizing you had something to do with that process some years ago, or seeing something on the telly about something that's happened in a part of government that you were engaged with. It's cool. It's a good place to be, and it is motivational, and certainly what keeps me going. And we tend to select people who work for us who have that same motivation, which is not just about a transactional come in, do some work, take some money, go home. It's about a sense of being engaged and actually making a difference. And in testing, you really do have the opportunity to make a significant difference. You know, some of my guys, some relatively junior people finding defects, if they'd got through to live, would have had a significant financial and wider impact. That's cool. That's really cool.
I think that it's undeniable. You can't get to a leadership position such as yours without having that kind of actual passion to some extent for what you're working on and what you're working towards.
But that's also part of the military thing, isn't it? Because the military gives you the esprit de corps, and an awful lot of the way the command structure works is by, even down to an individual rifleman, say an infantry, understanding their role in the bigger battle picture. So like when you give orders, you know, one of the things that you tell the people that you're giving orders to is the intent of your commander and their commander. And giving people that context, one is in part motivational, but also it's when things change, and things often do change, you know what the bigger picture is. So you understand and are empowered and able to make decisions about what do I do as a consequence. And it's that kind of thing that not only keeps you motivated, but allows people to be effective to make decisions and make decisions in context, so they're more likely to get it right and make a difference for the better.
When you look at your leadership style and leadership role, I'm assuming you take a lot of what you did in the military and kind of instill it in your guys and kind of empower them. how challenging was it for you when you had leadership roles outside of the military? Did you find it particularly challenging, or you know, how did you approach it? What was the challenges? You know, all the kind of nuances involved with that kind of transition.
So my first job out of university was working for Unisys as a consultant, and I joined them as a grad, so I went through their grad program. And I met a cracking chap who now works for McAfee called Alex Bedford, and we became great friends. And I remember one wonderful piece of advice that we did, you know, like you do on these grad programs, we did a mock project. We were over staying in the Holiday Inn in Brussels, so people from all over Europe working there. And he just said, yeah, well done, but just remember, you know, you can't talk to your team like they're in the back of an APC. I was like, you what? He said, they're not soldiers. And I was like, I don't know. And I was so used to a particular mode of engagement in management that I hadn't even realized that I was maybe speaking to people in a way that wasn't appropriate in a civilian environment. And it really made me take a step back and think about, like, while there are skills and capability that it is okay to bring with you, there are other things that you have to use in moderation or aren't appropriate. So, I mean, I have a particularly raw sense of humor that isn't for everyone, that's definitely inherited from the military. And you certainly can't use some of the fruity language that you use in the military environment in a civilian environment. It doesn't go down very well. So while there are positives, it's learning how to pick up from that tool set the bits and pieces that you can use. So, but then the flip side of that is, you know, in the military, you get exposed to a really wide range of people. So, you know, dealing from soldiers all the way up to fairly senior officers, and you get exposure to people. I know in my current role, I deal with people like the Lord Lieutenant of the City and County of Bristol, and you deal with sort of people, very senior people from charitable organisations. So it gives you a degree of confidence and social mobility and an exposure to a breadth of people that you don't tend to get in other walks of life. It teaches you the basics of how to interact and motivate with people. And a lot of like management theory that you get taught in the civilian world is stuff that comes naturally from the military environment, which is understanding people's motivation, their drivers. So all that stuff like Myers-Briggs, the hierarchy needs, that, you know, that's kind of implicit in the way you're trained. So you become more natural in the understanding and deployment of those things. But at the end of the day, you know, business is people doing stuff with people. We're not in a world where everything's done by robots and AI. And the bulk of certainly what I do is people doing stuff with people. So understanding that and providing motivation, support and enablement to that process, whether it's by your own engagement with clients and your own staff or just unblocking or helping, providing motivation for the people that you work with and for, it is so important. I think that's the part of the military ethos that really comes to the fore. You know, if you think about it, in the old days, the City of London, by way of example, a lot of the operations directors, COOs and those type of people came directly from the military. They'd, you know, come out of a guards regiment as a major or a colonel and find themselves the chief operating officer of an insurance company. And it's those kind of skills that allow them to drop into those roles quite quickly and easily. You know, when there were the 7/7 attacks on London, the chief operating officer of Barclays Banking Group at the time was, I believe, a former officer in the Royal Tank Regiment. And Barclays, on the day, was one of the large financial institutions in London that had the most effective response to what was going on. So by way of example, pretty much the first thing they seemed to have done was sought out, realizing that transport would be disruptive, is book a load of coaches before everyone else did, so the Barclays staff could get home while the public transport network was disrupted. And it's that kind of cool thinking but response to it that meant that people fell into those kind of roles. It's not so much the case anymore, and the shape of the army has changed, but also, you know, the significant change in the use of technology in the military means that if you go into a mobile telephone operator, you know, you'll find loads of ex-military staff from usually signals backgrounds knocking around there. You know, we joke about it, but you go into somewhere like EE or you know, one of those similar companies, and there's loads of ex-military guys from signals background working there.
Really interesting, mate. Really interesting. I'm conscious of time, mate. I obviously don't want to. I know you've got your day job. You know, I wish we could do a podcast all day, actually, to be fair. It's far more interesting. But, you know, just finally for me, you know, what is it now, you know, you with all the vast experience that you have, what do you think kind of fundamental characteristics that you have now, you know, that keep you pushing, motivated, you know, on a day to day to do, you know, the best work possible?
I think you've got to have a sense of humour. I think inevitably in business, things go wrong or things are challenging. I think emotional resilience is really, really important. And people deal with things in different ways. Some people smash it out in the gym. You know, I think having a sense of humour and a wider perspective is really important. I think finding the wonder in things. I'm a bit of a child. I'm interested in technology, but I'm not very geeky or techie. But I think a sense of wonder is great because you see the interest in things and you see the wider picture. And I think that's a really good way of keeping you engaged and avoiding the monotony of it. And I think that sense of wonder also then more broadly feeds into problem solving and intellect. And I think you've got to, you know, have a degree of intelligence to perform well in business. It's not to say, you know, if you think you can't do well. No, it's more to say that when you're in leadership roles or technology roles, there's a hell of a lot of complexity and you can't manage everything. So the ability to cut through the crap, to make sense of a situation and to make intelligent decisions is really important. And, you know, with the skill set to support that.
I like it, mate. Well, I really enjoyed the chat, Matt. Thank you so much for taking the time, mate. It was, I genuinely really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.